we all knew they were going to be late, right? We know that actually only Rich and I are currently watching this program. No, I bet you there's some other folks going, oh, please, anything other than more of this. Welcome. We'll keep you informed. I've got Fox News on over there, so they'll splash it across the screen here in a moment, I would imagine. But the Derek Chauvin verdict, and believe me, this is just the beginning. There will be all sorts of appeals, and who knows how long this will go. I don't know. I just sit back and I go, why would anyone want to become a cop today? Honestly, I mean, we know that people are retiring at an incredible rate, and a lot of places are nowhere near replacement as far as anything else goes. When you want a cop, all of a sudden you want a cop. But all this has to do with justice and the fact that there's only one. Look, think about it, folks. If God created this world, if this world is what Jesus said it was, then the only way it's going to function properly is if we order it according to what? Well, there are some Christians that would say if we order it according to nature and natural theology and things along those lines. Well, that's not what gave us the foundations of a free society. So what are we going to be facing? I don't know. I don't know. But we'll let you know. We've got things to get to that are far more frustrating, to be perfectly honest with you. And I refer to the story of Rob Hoogland. Rob Hoogland. You've probably not heard the name. You probably didn't hear the name. And I hesitate to even mention this, but I saw the video last night. It was just horrific. Of the little 7-year-old girl that was killed, undoubtedly, in a gang shooting in Chicago yesterday, in the drive-through lane at a McDonald's. And the video that I saw where they were trying to get into the car, they didn't know about it yet, and then when the cops, and they're all white cops as far as I could see, got the car open and pulled her out, and they're running to one of their cars. They're not waiting for an ambulance. They're running to one of their cars to try to save this baby, 7 years old, this young child, who has been shot in gang violence. May have had something to do with drugs, could have been so many of these are mistaken identities and all sorts of stuff like this. But it is, you would think that if there was the slightest bit of consistency in the world, that would be the big story, but it's not. Because it's not politically, there is no political advantage to be gained by the left, and the left controls the media. So you probably haven't even heard her name, won't hear her name. There will not be three nationally televised funerals, because what you're seeing today, what we're watching right now, the fact that we're glued to the television right now, clear demonstration that justice has been polluted by political power. And that's the wonderful, beautiful thing about God's law. You're not allowed to do that. You have specific commands to not favor the rich over the poor or the poor over the rich. Either one. Justice is to be done. It would change everything if we still had in our society the concept of blood guiltiness. That's just not there. That's just not there anywhere anymore. There was once a respect for life because there was a recognition that life came from God's hand. Darwin did this to us all. Darwin opened the door to this. Darwin opened the door to everyone being treated as an animal. And there you go. So Rob Hoogland is a father up in Canada. Now, Canada, I don't know what's going on in Canada. I really, really honestly do not know what's going on in Canada. But this is an ongoing story in regards to a man and his teenage daughter. I don't know how much longer, I don't know how much longer we will even be able to use the accurate English words to describe what is being done to his daughter's body against his will, but with the mother's approval. There's someone who's going to be, there's a day of judgment. There is a day of judgment. And we don't like to tell people that. But you have to. There will be a day of judgment. I don't know how much longer we will even be able to use the proper language to describe the actual surgical processes that are being allowed and promoted within Western societies for females, and there are only males and females. That's the real world. But the real world is, you know, we're in denial of the real world. The real world found guilty of third-degree murder, okay? Guilty of third-degree murder. I don't know what that means. I'm sure that that will be discussed. And, you know, if you're listening to this 3 years later, you know, the Derek Chauvin stuff just came in. Chauvin found guilty of third-degree murder. Just popped up on the screen, so there you go. I've recommended to you, and I will recommend it to you again very, 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 very strongly. Irreversible Damage, Abigail Schreier. She has, man, give that woman a prize for bravery, for sticking to her guns, and just speaking the truth. The pressure that has been placed upon her for speaking the truth is absolutely amazing. But read the book. Fathers, read the book. Take the time so you have some idea of what is going on and why there has been this explosion of alleged transgenderism and the destructive results in the lives of the young girls. And look, I may be moving toward, and I'm much, much, much younger than Rich. Much, much, much younger. And it's obvious. And you know, he's already in his seventh decade. And I'm almost there myself. Wow. Chauvin found guilty of all charges now. So I don't know what that means. So there you go. I'm gonna have to close that because you can't think and have that up as well. But guilty on all counts, I guess. The results in the lives of these young girls, what they are robbed of, what is done to their bodies, most of us just can't even begin to imagine it. They are lied to. They are deceived. The effect of testosterone injection, the destruction of the reproductive system, and of course, either the what's called binding, or eventually full-on mastectomies, leaving these young girls without the option and the opportunity of being mothers in the future, of nursing a child, of bringing life into this world. And they're being, you know, we all remember, I'm getting up there, but I remember my teenage years. In fact, there are probably, as I think back on it now, to be honest with you, I have clearer memories of junior high and high school than I have of most of my 20s and 30s. Those are very formative years. And they're very confusing years. And there's all those hormones raging, and there's all, you know, your shoe size gets bigger every single time you got to get another pair of shoes, and you're awkward, and all sorts of pressures. And yeah, we all went through it. We all went through it. And can you imagine if one of the options when I was that age was, you're the wrong gender. Really? Wow. Here I had a fairly narrow range of possibilities. And that is, you know, as a man, I need to man up, and I need to be what I was called to be when God made me a man. And my parents drove it into me, you know, you turn 18 and you need to be ready to be a man and live and make ends meet and the whole nine yards, you know? Yeah, that was a long time ago. I think a lot of people consider that to be child abuse today, to be perfectly honest with you. But it wasn't. It was exactly what was needed. But yeah, we all went through difficult times. But no one was insane enough or insanely evil enough to suggest that the best way to deal with this would be to take massively destructive drugs like Lupron that the puberty blockers, that they're just presented as these wonderful things. Hey, this gives us time to figure out who we are. No, it doesn't. It destroys your body. It stops your mental development. Oh, that makes sense, since our society today seems to be stuck at about age 6 as it is, all the way through life, age 6. I'm offended by everything. In fact, I just realized I didn't pull that up. I need to pull it up. I hope I can remember to find this. This is what we're facing. So Rob Hoogland, sorry, he's cried out for help. The legal system in Canada has decided to go full on into this insanity. And in fact, the very language that's used, they talk about treatments and medical care and all the rest of this stuff, and it's mutilation is what it is. And so, reading an article about how a judge accepted a plea deal and then rejected it after having gotten him to confess and chucks him in the slammer, and he's going to be kept there. And what's the biggest, worst thing he's done is he's cried out for help. My daughter is going to be ruined. Well, you can't call her your daughter, because she will be hurt by that. She will be hurt by reality. That's where Canadian law is now. That's where our law is. That's where Western law is. There's no connection to reality anymore. There's been a redefinition of reality. And it's pure rebellion. You can try to make an argument, if you want, about certain people having gender dysphoria. You compare 2021 to 1991, and you have to explain why there is such a massive difference. There was almost none of that in 1991. Now it's everywhere. Why? Because it's not real. Because it is a societally produced delusion, destructive delusion. is what it is. But this delusion is now considered to be the moral good, and the ostensible president of the United States, who I don't think is there, I don't know who's running the country, but it certainly isn't Joe Biden, because to run the country, you have to be able to put three sentences in a row on the same subject together, and he is not capable of doing that. So I don't know who's running the country. But 18 months ago, that man was either made to say or actually managed to say on his own that the civil rights issue of our day is transgender rights. No, human rights, not civil rights, human rights. It's transgender rights. So we have completely abandoned any concern whatsoever of standing within the realm of human history. We have decided that every generation up before the year 2000 was a bunch of Neanderthalic morons, hate-filled, nasty people that could not think nearly as beautifully as we can. It is astonishing. And so Rob Hoogland, I don't see any evidence that he's a Christian or anything like that. I don't know. But he's a dad who's tried to do something to save his daughter. The sad thing is, what's probably going to happen 20 years from now is she's going to come to him ruined, single, totally messed up, and say, "Dad, thanks. I now know. I get it now. Thanks for having tried. Thanks for having ruined your life to try to save me." That's probably what's going to happen. I hope so. I hope so. I would rather that the Lord intercede, but Here's the situation we're facing. Which reminds me, here it is. Okay, I do have it. Our dear brother Samuel Say just does seem to get himself into trouble all the time. And given how young he is, I mean, I get myself into trouble all the time, but I've had decades more than Samuel has had to practice getting myself into trouble. He seems to be really good at it at a very young age. I'm not sure exactly what his age is, but it took me to almost like 28 or so to get into trouble. By the way, I ain't getting a dime out of this. Zojirushi. Z-O-J-I-R-U-S-H. Zojirushi. I filled this thing up with fizzy water and some electrolytes and ice and stuff, and I left it on my desk here yesterday. 24 hours later, I come back. It's still as cold as ice. I gotta admit, and this top thing won't leak. Which other ones, man, I'll tell you, if I made a mess with some of my other ones that have the straw thing, and it spilled all over my car and me and everything else. I don't get a dime, but that thing works. that thing really, really does work. Anyway, good old Samuel Say, he went, to the Ambrose student, well, the statement from the Ambrose Student Council came out yesterday. And evidently, he went to the Well event. He was a guest speaker in February, so a few weeks ago, at the Well event. And Samuel said words. Yes. He said words. And those words required you to think about words. And to think about other views than the warm, fuzzy, cuddly, I'm still in the womb because I'm 4 years old context of what it means to be at Ambrose. And we all know now that you don't go to university anymore to learn anything. You don't go there to grow. You don't go there to experience other perspectives and to for iron sharpening iron. Oh, no. You go to Ambrose to find safe places so that everyone thinks the same and dresses the same and acts the same so that you can be a comfortable, warm, mind-numbed zombie. Because that's what everybody wants to be now, is a mind-numbed zombie. And then this mean man, who happens to be very, very black. I mean, he's not brown. He's black. Okay, there's a difference between brown and black. So there's deep African black and not so deep African brown. Well, he's black, so he can't hide nothing. But he said words that are not supposed to be said by anyone, but especially not by a black person. No. And so, immediately, and it, is there a, somebody has to have typed up a template for this. Because they all sound the same. It's not like they can even come up with an expressive way of saying these things anymore. The apology thing, you know? It doesn't get you anywhere. The mob doesn't care. They want to hear the apology before they string you up. But, anyway. Statement from Ambrose Student Council President Lauren Schmidtke, I bet you she's not black, and Director of Social Justice Amy Bork, not that Bork, who is long gone and probably very happy to be long gone. As a council, we would like to take the time to acknowledge we have invited speakers to come and speak to our student body who have caused harm and offense with the words that they have spoken. In response to this happening, we are actively working to form strong expectations and accountability measures regarding the process of facilitating externally related speakers to encourage and maintain Ambrose University's commitments to foster inclusivity and dismantle systemic racism. We are the woke, and we can only say certain words. We cannot think on our own. We cannot interact because we have the mental and spiritual and emotional maturity of six-year-olds. And I'm being kind to say six-year-olds. I have a five-year-old that's wiser than this. Five-year-old grandchild, obviously. I'm not Jeff Durbin. I don't have both grandchildren and babies all at the same time, which is really confusing. And I think probably causes sleep deprivation, which is why Jeff doesn't know how long he's preaching. So anyway, I didn't mean to get into that. Anyway. I know that he listens and he will wake up at that point from his sleep deprivation. Anyways, six-year-olds. That's what this is about. I mean, listen to this. Who have caused harm. Wait a minute. An adult is not harmed by hearing a perspective that they disagree with, or maybe they've never heard before. In fact, children aren't harmed by that either. There is no harm there. But I thought that might be Jeff, but it wasn't. It was Tom Buck being a Tom Buck is troublemaker from Dallas. He's doing his thing. Texas. He's not really in Dallas, but anyway. There is no harm in hearing someone else's perspective. But that's where we are now. That's why China has put out an app to allow the Chinese people to snitch on other Chinese people who express inappropriate opinions. There's Jeff. who express inappropriate opinions. And I said, coming to us in 2022, and someone said, it's already here, it's called Twitter. And there's a sense in which that's true. There's a sense in which that's true. But can you see? I can see it in Canada right now. If Canada rolled out an app like this, that would allow you to report people for not masking, to report people for gathering and together, to report people for daring to point out that an Indian actor, a famous Indian comedian, died one day after getting the AstraZeneca vaccine, just a couple days ago. And now everybody in that province doesn't want to get it for obvious reasons. If you say that, you get reported because that goes against what the government wants people to be thinking. We've been trying to tell you for a while what totalitarianism means. And it's so sad to me that Christians, especially, I'm just so tired of you talking about politics. Excuse me. Do you understand what totalitarianism means coming from a secular government? It means the end of your freedom to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, to even think in accordance with biblical parameters. It is the foundation of wiping the Bible off of the electronic landscape, of making it illegal to publish it. They've done it in the past. China is literally going to try to come up with their own version of the Bible. You don't think they're going to do that? You are as naive as a 3-year-old if you think that. Wake up, grow up. Don't you see the relationship of these things? How can you be so naive? It's astonishing. It really is. I don't get it. Stop talking about this stuff. What are we supposed to talk about? Well, you just need to do some more stuff in church history. I've done hours of it. We'll do more hours of it on Thursday. I'm doing it all the time. But you can't stick your head in the sand because eventually it's going to come around to 2:00 Mountain Standard Time on a Thursday and we won't be here. We won't be here. And you're going to go online to see what's going on and our entire library will be gone. And some of you are like, you know, don't realize we've been doing this for a long time. I think we're close to 2,000 episodes on Sermon Audio. Because we were at 19 something, and I think we're probably over 2,000 now, or at least very close to that. Think of how many hours that is. And that's not even including going back to the 80s, because the dividing line started mid-1980s. Was that when we started, 88? Okay. Well, I know I was doing stuff. I was doing stuff before then. So we've been doing this a long, long time. And it's going to be gone. Now, sure, we have it all backed up, but how you get it to people, that's going to be the issue. And this is coming, and it's coming for every single one of us. Unless you are willing to simply capitulate. So I don't get you folks who just, you're doing the, well, they won't bother me. I'm vaccinated and wear 3 masks. No, they'll get to you eventually. They just know you're no danger already. You're compliant. You'll do whatever you're told. That's what it's been all about. It's about compliance. But they'll get to you. Unless you get to the point where you go, okay, I've got to make a choice, and I offer the pinch of incense. I give in. I will adopt the state-mandated religion because that's better than anything else. Now there are going to be some people that are going to do that. There are going to be a lot of people that are going to do that. No two ways about it. Anyway, just listening to all this stuff, cause harm and offense with the words that they have spoken. I will confess, it is very, very difficult for me to talk to people like this. My generation, the generation before mine, that's the generation that defeated the Axis powers. This idea, I mean, as a child, I remember singing, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And that is now, if you said that in almost any university classroom in the Western world now, you'd be fired. Because it's heresy. It's cultural heresy. Which means that university culture is pretty much stuck in first grade. And I have a hard time looking at a person who is physically an adult and have to try to reason with them as they really are a child. That's tough. It's a character flaw. No two ways about it. In February 2021, a guest speaker at the Well event denied the existence of systemic racism and caused severe harm to those who were in attendance. Yes. You know what we need? I'm sorry, Sammy. this just hit me. But there's a scene in The Holy Grail where the guy, who was it, Galahad? I forget which one it was, comes bursting into the castle and just starts chopping everybody up. He karate kicks the bride and kills the bride's father, and he's running people through with swords all over the place and just destroying everybody. Somehow we need to make Samuel that guy, because that's what this sounds like. I mean, he caused severe harm to those who were in attendance. He ran through with a big verbal sword and he made people cry. Oh. I'm sorry. It's just, I was student body president in sixth grade. We had just moved out here. I went through fifth grade back in Pennsylvania, sixth grade at Park Meadows Elementary School. Over on 35th Avenue, out in the middle. Back then, it was out in the middle of nowhere. Now it's obviously in the middle of everything. But, and so I decided the best way to get to know everybody was I was going to run for student body president. And I won! Because I gave the best speech, you know. Everybody else just had like, I'll see if I can get us 5 more minutes of recess time, you know. And I had this whole thing about, you know, what we could do because we're a new school and they just opened it up and, but we should, and everybody's like, wow, you know, voted for me. All right. So I was student body president. And, I know what it was in sixth grade to, you know, we had stuff come before the student body, student council about discipline issues and whole nine yards. I can guarantee you something, that in sixth grade, we would have listened to this and we would have laughed and said, are you from second grade? Which grade? What do you, we're the big sixth graders here. What are you doing here? What is wrong with you? Cause severe harm to those who are in attendance. We want to make it explicitly clear that these are not the views of the Ambrose Student Council wants to endorse. In a public statement issued by Ambrose University in the summer of 2020, our institution acknowledges the existence of systemic racism and its commitment to working to dismantle systems of oppression within our own system. We are committed. We are a part of the cult. And we will not question this. You know what this reminds me of? How many times I have stood with a Mormon missionary, and I've gone through false prophecies of Joseph Smith, and I've gone through errors in the Book of Mormon, and I've gone through contradictions in the Doctrine and Covenants, and I've gone through the Book of Abraham, which is the nuclear weapon as far as the historicity of Mormonism is concerned. And when you get done, the Mormon missionary goes, you've just strengthened my testimony. Because that's all they've got. They can't reason with you. They can't argue with you. That's all they've got. We want to acknowledge the harm that was caused, because there's only one view. There is only one acceptable way to think. You can't write this stuff if you have not already had your critical thinking capacities suctioned out of your head by a public education system. You can't do it. This is the Ministry of Truth, 1984, George Orwell. You re-edit everything to make, there's only one way of thinking. And the party tells you what it is. We want to acknowledge the harm that was caused as a result of the statements made by the past guest speaker. You've been canceled, Samuel. Canceled. Who shall remain unnamed, but you've been canceled. The past guest speaker, and send a sincere apology to those who have been denigrated. Ambrose Student Council is committed to increasing the degree of safety, inclusivity, which only means our view, and diversity, which only means our view, that all Ambrose students have a right to, which is our view, and no one else's. You cannot think any other way than we do. How long did it take us to get here? What kind of foundational worldview corruption had to take place to get to this point? Yeah. Oh, yeah. To further this effort, AASC has created a new policy in our bylaws that will ensure a proper and thorough vetting process for guest speakers that align with the views and beliefs of the institution. We shall have no other views than the one view. You will think like us. You will speak like us. Get in line, zombie! Oh, it's amazing! I mean, if this was meant to be a joke, then it's so well done. But it's not. This is the future generation. These are your future totalitarians. Right here. And they're already stamped, formed, ready to go. It's just absolutely astonishing. Oh, okay. I'm not sure how to do that. This is absolutely astonishing. I was just getting some help from the studio audience. Well, not this studio, but out there in the world. And I'm sorry, I don't know how to be winsome about something like this. I'm supposed to whisper more. I don't know how to. Same time, Summer texts me and says my grandkids are really entertained by how worked up I am. It's Samuel's fault. So I think that Summer and Joy need to have Samuel on Sheologians. I don't know what that would do about the situation, but it would make me feel better. Rich is looking rather bemused over there too. I'm sorry. These are future leaders. What do you got for me? What do you got for me? What are you doing here? Am I supposed to hear something? Or are you going to put something up or what? Is that applause? Oh. Actually, that sounded like rain on a tin roof. That's the worst sound effect thing I've ever heard. Okay. Rich had been playing with sound effects earlier. Don't worry. I'm not going to let him start doing that. That would make us way too much like certain other people out there. Anyway, I'm sorry. It's just really, really hard for me to... to look at that. Okay, let me get off of that because I'm going to go absolutely insane. I almost didn't say anything about this because it's one of those situations like, where can this really go, especially in Twitter? But a guy, I do not know the gentleman. He may be the nicest fellow on God's green earth. He's probably much nicer than I am. Named Danny Slavich. And I clicked on his stuff, and he has a PhD from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. That means he's a smart guy. But I ran across a statement that he made. He was retweeting something by a fellow by the name of Alan Cross, who was going after Michael Fallon. And in the process, naming me, Josh Weiss, Tom Askell, Vody Balcom, proud to be in that group. But what he said, I let pass. I it was late in the evening, and I went, getting old, and I let it pass. But it was back in my mind the next morning, and it popped back up, and so I made a comment. But here's what he said. Danny Slavich said, "We chose to fight a boogeyman rather than for our brethren. The, quote, threat of CRT, close quote, in the church is not real. The threat of CRT in the church is not real. It's been manufactured based on misrepresentation, false accusation, half-truths, and innuendo. At the expense of many brothers and sisters of color, we chose poorly." And that then he, quote, tweets the Alan Cross thing about Michael Fallon, Sovereign Nations. And that then that has a, quote, tweet. So it's a, quote, tweet. I'm not sure how that works. Where he talks about myself, Josh Weiss, Tom Askell, Vody Balcom. And mentioned that I had to listen to him for years talking about that type of stuff. And it's true. We did have to listen to him for years. But we did listen, Mike. Thought you were a little weird, but we did listen, okay? We stayed friends. Anyway, then he went on to say, "Show me one single Marxist or even theological moderate in an SBC entity. They aren't there. Not a one. There's no one who's ever done anything that talked about white privilege and intersectionality and Black Lives Matter and James Cone. No, not a one. It's never happened. Everyone to a man and woman gladly and proudly affirms the inerrancy of Scripture in the BFM 2000. Now, I've had to sit here for decades and say, folks, look, I taught for years for Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary. That's a fact. They may wish that wasn't the case, but that's a fact. And had great students and love still hearing from those students to this day. And had a positive impact upon those students as well. But I knew then, because I had to sign that thing. I had to sign the thing about inerrancy, Baptist faith and message. I had to sign it. Everybody did. But I knew what was being taught in classes, especially on the main campus, which they don't own anymore because it was probably the primest property in the entire Mill Valley area. I mean, it's beautiful. Loved my time there, but it's gone now. But I knew what was being taught. And the reality is that scholars have mechanisms that allow them to say, I believe in inerrancy, while not believing in inerrancy. It's a redefinition. It's a redefinition of what the term has meant since the days of Warfield, but I would argue what it meant all the way back to the early church. Because the understanding and recognition of Scripture as the Word of God, as being the very speaking of God, has fundamental necessary components to it that are not always a part of how professors at Southern Baptist entities and many other schools, PCA, sadly, OPC, let alone the farther you go to the left, the professors in those places have a way of getting around. They don't really believe that. I know that in believing in inerrancy, I am very much in a very small minority. And will not, there's no reason for me to even pretend to ever have a place at the big boys table anymore. Not looking for it. Not looking for it. Not interested in it. So, when I hear someone say that they gladly and proudly affirms the inerrancy of Scripture, I just want to go, Right. You cannot proudly affirm the inerrancy of Scripture and then turn around and quote from James Cone. The cognitive dissonance is too great. You cannot turn around and say, I am actually a racist and always will be because I'm white. And then talk about the inerrancy of Scripture. Because see, the inerrancy of Scripture means it's not just the dead affirmation that it's theologically accurate. It's actually sufficient in and of itself, which means what it teaches about the unity of the body and the fact that you are justified through the imputed righteousness of Christ is true and real, and you're going to live in light of it. That's the issue. So I read those two tweets where it says that the threat of CRT has been manufactured based on misrepresentation. False accusation, half-truths, innuendo. And I'm, Michael Fallon is the primary target, but via the tweet, myself, Josh Bice, Tom Askell, Bodie Balcom, we're all being thrown in the same boat. And then I think of how many hours of CRT-influenced blather I have had to listen to over the past number of years. The number of pages of printed material I've had to read or listen to over the past number of years. And that's why I said, what planet is this guy living on? The video documentation is so extensive that it's really, really difficult to understand this. But this is the methodology that is being utilized. There isn't even a threat out there, folks. There is not even a threat. Those guys, they've just lost it. They've just lost it. They really have. Anyway, I'm sorry. Taking too much time on all these things. There is another thing here I want to look at real quick. And that is Trent Horn. And we're not doing a Trent Horn history thing, though I've been enjoying that. And I want to thank, I think it was somebody at Apologia that asked me, could you please respond to this? And I'm enjoying it. I hope everybody else is. I mean, we're obviously going a lot more in depth than was probably expected. But it's enjoyable to have the opportunity to delve into this stuff and to talk about the history and things like that. I enjoy it mainly because it also helps us to escape the infantile situation that we are in right now. But someone had put up a poll, Protestants, are Catholics Christians? And Trent had commented, so far only 5% of Protestants in this poll believe Catholics aren't Christians. 40 years ago, it would have been way higher. I think he's right about that. I'm grateful for apologists working long before me who have built a foundation for Protestants and Catholics to jointly evangelize a post-Christian world. Now, that's interesting. This raises some real interesting questions. For example, what I have been saying during this program about CRT, I would imagine, in general, that Trent Horn has just as much problems with CRT as I do. And so when we're talking about a lot of things, there's a lot of crossover now. What this means is, and I don't know how long ago it was I started talking about this, but as we are pushed closer and closer and closer into a smaller portion of the societal pie, the issue that's raised right here, can Protestants and Catholics jointly evangelize a post-Christian world? What does that mean? Because to evangelize is to proclaim a gospel. And we don't have the same gospel. And that was something I think everybody agreed on. Well, I'm not sure if that's the case. But certainly when I sat in the Bible Answer Man studio with Tim Staples, I think Tim Staples is still with Catholic Answers, isn't he? I haven't heard almost anything about Tim for a long time. But I think he is. We talked about this very issue. And I said then, if you and I are standing outside an abortion clinic, and this comes up a lot because our folks are outside a lot of abortion clinics, and basically, since we believe that the gospel is the issue, that has created a real division with the Roman Catholics, because we're not preaching the same gospel. And so I asked him, if we're standing outside an abortion clinic, and someone walks up to us and says, what must I do to be saved? Will you say right here and now, on this program, that our answers would be fundamentally different? They would be contradictory answers. And he said, yes. Now that was 2000-ish. So that was 20 years ago. Trent, would you not say that we would give different answers? And if we do, how do we jointly evangelize a post-Christian world unless the evangel does not include how a person actually enters into relationship with Jesus Christ? And that's what makes me wonder. He said, this doesn't mean Catholics and Protestants should never discuss their disagreements. We absolutely should, but we also need to recognize the growing crisis of unbelief, and that we can a lot from each other when it comes to graciously addressing it. I think there's probably learn or something disappeared in there, which is easy to understand on Twitter. Yes, we can graciously address it. And we have sought to graciously address Trent a number of times over the years. But I don't know how the joint evangelism takes place without so under-defining the evangel that it's no longer a coherent message. That's really the question. That's really the question. All right. I'll hold off on the face mask stuff. There was some great stuff that came out on that recently. I remain astonished. An article came out on Bart Ehrman's blog, 3 days ago? 3 days ago. Nope, Jesus is not Yahweh, the Bart Ehrman blog. Now, ever since Bart Ehrman debated that fellow from Dallas Seminary, who brought this up and said, well, wait, what about Paul in Philippians 2? He quotes passage about Yahweh, applies it to Jesus. Every knee bow, every tongue confess, you know, will not give his glory to another. This is about Yahweh. And Bart just looked like a deer in a headlight. That's Sabellianism. No, that's not Sabellianism. What are you talking about? It really seems like Bart Ehrman slept through systematic theology class at Moody. I mean, and evidently will not be corrected. It does not surprise me that a Princeton Seminary grad from his days would have never read Warfield, but I'd invite him to try it for a second to find out that the seminary he graduated from, that one of its greatest professors of all time would set him straight on this, have an idea of what this is all about, but he doesn't get it. After all these years, after how many people have pointed out, he just, when it comes to theology, Bart Ehrman is not a reliable source at all. At all. He does not understand Christian theology very well at all, and he's not willing to learn. But here's what he says. He says, in my last post, I pointed out that some conservative evangelical Christians, maybe others, these are the ones I know about, claim that Jesus in the Bible is actually to be understood as Yahweh. I think that's completely wrong, and in this post, I want to explain why. Again, if someone knows better than I do, let me know. Well, how about B.B. Warfield? You're a Princeton grad. That's where your PhD is from. All right? Go to B.B. Warfield. Simple enough? There are many others. But I've never even heard the claim, let alone discussion of it, until very recently. Really? I wonder if there are any early Christian theologians who have this view. Really? Or even later ones, prior to recent times? Ooh. Well, there was those strange things that Justin Martyr said to Trypho the Jew that identified Jesus as Yahweh. That was the middle of the second century? Huh? Yeah, he's a historian, but it doesn't look like he's good with the theology of the things. It is not the view of traditional Christian theology, at least as I learned it once upon a time. Do you hear these weasel words? You mean as you didn't learn it once upon a time? It was certainly not the view of the earliest Christians. It is not a view set forth in the Bible. The Bible, of course, does not have the Trinity. But when Christianity formulated the doctrine of the Trinity, the Father was Yahweh and Christ was his Son. At least that's what Christians who read their Old Testament said. Now, I told everybody, hey, save this. Save this article. Lest it disappear into the mists of time. Because, wow. Here is Bart Ehrman assuming Unitarianism and hence ignoring passage after passage after passage where the New Testament writers identify the Son as Yahweh. They identify the Father as Yahweh as well. And there's the problem. He was never a Trinitarian because he was never actually a Christian. He never understood it. And now he's tilting at windmills. Want some examples? I didn't think you would ever ask. More than happy to provide a few. People who listen to this program, you should, off the top of your head, be able to give numerous examples where Jesus identified as Yahweh in the New Testament. You should be able to give examples where the Father is identified as Yahweh as well, because they both are, and that's the point. The same New Testament. See, and this is why Bart can't do systematic theology, is he does not believe that you can do systematic theology. He says, the Bible doesn't know anything about the Trinity. You can't understand the New Testament without understanding the Trinity. The writers absolutely would be babbling incoherently, which is basically what he thinks they're doing, if you don't have the doctrine of the Trinity. If you don't recognize that Peter was an experiential Trinitarian. He heard the Father speak from heaven. He walked with the Son. He's now indwelt by the Holy Spirit. But that requires you believing that the Bible is a consistent whole, which is the fundamental thing that Bart Ehrman does not want you to believe. And he doesn't, so therefore he can't even begin to meaningfully comment on what the New Testament teaches. Because from his perspective, the New Testament teaches nothing. The New Testament does not teach anything. The New Testament teaches differing and contradictory views depending on which book of the Bible you're reading. All right? So, where would you go? Well, there are so many. It's so cold. I love it. See, you got it. Before you go to the text, you got to remember, I'm so old. Rich, would you? You know, we need to possibly get some rocking chairs, so that you and I can just, well, we can rock in these, I suppose. So you and I can start. Yeah, I got a rocking chair. But did you ever have a lunchbox that you took to school? Did it have like Scooby-Doo or Superman or anything like that? Hot Wheels, you bet. That was good. Yep. And it was, they were embossed and had the, you know, really colorful and stuff. And inside, what would you have? Aside from whatever sandwich your mom made you that morning, and maybe some Cheetos or Fritos. What's the Frito-Lay things you like? Just Fritos. That's right, Fritos. But you also had a thermos bottle. Now, they were way too breakable, weren't they? Because it was glass inside. But they were thermos bottles. But to keep it cold, even to lunch, they had to be so thick that there wasn't much in there. I mean, these things would have been awesome back then. So you see, I'm fascinated by this because here is technology, man. I'm still thinking about my plastic and glass Superman, Spider-Man, whatever it was, thermos in my. I'm wondering if my grandkids are going, I'd like to have one of those. Now, I bet you they've got them on eBay someplace. There's probably a few that haven't broken over the years that we could track down. But how did I get on that? Oh, yes, before we get to the text, there we go. Where do you go? Well, there are so many. I'm just going to cover two real quick. You already are familiar with these, and especially if you listen to the sermon that I did at G3 last year and then repeated at Apologia, this is one that you know. And this is just the place that I would just immediately go, especially with someone like Bart Ehrman. We challenged Bart Ehrman to debate this subject, but we didn't have $25,000 to pay. Plus what? Oh yeah, and he retains all media rights. So if he didn't like how it went, then no one would ever see it. So we said, no, I don't think so. But we would be happy to debate Bart Ehrman on this because there's no way he can win. He's wrong, demonstrably wrong. And here's an example of it. So in John chapter 12, at the end of Jesus' public ministry, I guess I can go ahead and end of Jesus' public ministry. For this reason, verse 39, they could not believe, for Isaiah said again, quoting from the Greek Septuagint, he has blinded their eyes, and he hardened their hearts, so that they would not see with their eyes and perceive with their heart and be converted, and I heal them. This is a quotation from Isaiah chapter 6. I see that right over there, if you want to verify that. This is from Isaiah's great temple vision, where I saw the Lord. Now, the first statement is saw Adonai. But then it's Yahweh speaking all the way through Isaiah chapter 6, sends Isaiah on and makes him his prophet and sends him on his mission, so on and so forth. And, of course, he's the one who is surrounded by the cherubim. Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. And this is the vision that we have in Isaiah chapter 6. Then notice what John 12:41 says. These things, tell to Ipen Esaias, Isaiah, notice he's quoting from the Greek Septuagint, Hati Iden tain daxon autu, kai elalesen peri autu. So, Isaiah said these things. Now, what does he just quote from? Isaiah 6, temple vision. Because he saw his glory and he spoke about him. Now, if you think that somehow the subject has changed, next verse says, nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in him, eis auton, believed in him, but because the Pharisees, they were not confessing him publicly, they put out of the synagogue. Who's the him? Jesus. So these things Isaiah said because he saw his glory and he spoke about him. So Isaiah, whose glory did you see? I saw Yahweh's glory. John, whose glory did Isaiah see? He saw Jesus' glory. Now, It's even stronger than that, as we've pointed out, because there is a fascinating textual variant in the Greek Septuagint in comparison to the Hebrew Masoretic text. And again, if you want a further discussion of this, like I said, the G3 sermon I did last year, and I had a little bit more time to develop it, Apologia Church, so that would have been, well, February, March, somewhere. It was right after we got back. You can look it up, Apologia Studios, on YouTube. But there is a textual variant here. And in Isaiah 6:1, in the Septuagint, instead of it saying what the Hebrew says, the train of his robe was filling the temple, it says his glory filled the house. And so the one place, because some people tried to get around this, they were saying, well, he also quoted from Isaiah 53 up above, and so maybe that was, no. The one place where glory is seen is in Isaiah 6 in the Greek Septuagint, which would be the translation of the scriptures that the people John's writing to would have in their own possession. So when he says Isaiah said these things because he saw his glory, there's no question of what he's citing from. It's Isaiah's temple vision. It's where Isaiah saw Yahweh, and it's about Jesus. He saw him and spoke concerning him. Fits perfectly with John 1:1-18. Who is the monogenes theos, the unique God that exegetes the Father? Jesus. Now, again, Ehrman assumes Unitarianism. Has to. He doesn't have any divine revelation. So he has to assume Unitarianism. But then all you then can say is, well, okay, the New Testament writers contradict themselves. No, they didn't. There is something greater, which is why you're an apostate. And don't believe. And didn't understand. And misrepresent even now. John 12. So, anybody else do that? Well, we know others did that. We know that Paul does it a number of times. But I think it's fascinating to just remind us of, because it lets us go back to the Greek Septuagint again. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 14, but even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed, and do not fear their intimidation and don't be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Now, notice that in the New American Standard, do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled is in all caps. And that is because that is a citation from, you'll see it right over here, Isaiah 8:12. The problem is, if they were consistent, and notice over here in the Greek, you'll notice the italics, the Nestle 28, Tande faban auton me fabetheta meda taraktheta. And then look at this. Kurion is still in italics. Hagiatheta is still in italics. So why didn't these two over here end up in italics? I wish they had. If there was going to be consistency, the New American Standard should have put sanctify, which is hagiazo, and kurion, Lord, in italics as well, because it's continuation of the same quotation from Isaiah 8. Now, there is a variant here. The Textus Receptus has a different reading than the Nestle-Aland text does at this point. You'll notice right here, the Textus Receptus has theon, and that's the Byzantine reading, over against P72, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, etc., etc. It's basically the earliest text versus the later text is the, Now it's visible. But, so 1 Peter 3:15 isn't accessible to TR-only folks and King James-only as far as that goes. But here you literally have, but treat as holy the Messiah as kurios, and that kurios is the Greek Septuagint's rendering of the Tetragrammaton, Yahweh. But treat as holy Christ as Yahweh in your hearts. Always ready to give, to make a defense, everyone asks you a reason. That's, if you've heard me speak on 1 Peter 3, I've confessed for a decade now that I had spoken on that text over and over and over again as an apologist, because it's the key apologetics text, and had never seen what the background was. And it is recognizing who Christ is, that he is God in human flesh, that prioritizes everything else so that you will respond to all the difficulties and challenges of life differently. And that's what will cause people to ask you a reason for the hope that's within you. They will see the hope that's within you because you prioritize in light of Jesus being who this text says he is. Just one of many, just one of many that demonstrate Paul, Peter, John, they all do the same thing. Bart Ehrman's wrong. I don't know why. I don't know how this huge hole in his history and training and theology is to be explained, but there it is. He was exposed to that debate, and he continues to do that as well. All right, one last thing. My good brother Chris, I think he's still down Texas way. He graduated recently, and we say congratulations to him. I don't know how he's going to survive, because I was earlier saying, why would anyone want to become a police officer? Well, he did. Tough days to be doing that. But Brother Chris made a comment, and I said, I'm going to respond to that. Might as well, because it can be done properly, and I think it's useful. This was back on the 13th. Just made a comment on Twitter. He says, I think the problem with theonomy is that you have unregenerate men attempting to apply and submit others to God's law. It didn't work in Geneva, and I don't believe it would work in America. Well, once again, the issue is what you think theonomy is meaning. And I think as more and more people recognize that the church needs to have a strongly prophetic message for the culture, the idea that something like the Noahic covenant is enough, or the idea that the general light of nature, folks, the general light of nature has a father in prison in Canada for trying to save his daughter from the insanity of transgenderism. That general light of nature thing ain't working too good. Because here's the problem. That nature needs to be understood in light of God's revelation as to who man is. We now live in a society that has secularized to the point where you have a majority of people who view us as ugly bags of mostly water, as stardust, as fizzing chemicals, whatever other terminology you want to use. By the way, I preached a sermon Sunday night, and it was a tough sermon. It wasn't a fun sermon. It's not a happy clappy sermon. It's not a I feel so much better about myself sermon. I don't think anybody felt very good about themselves out of that sermon. But I would direct you to it if you have been thinking about what foundational work you can be doing to try to be prepared to deal with horrible persecution in the future, especially persecution where you would be separated from other believers and from everybody, because they're doing that to believers in China. Isolating them. That's what communists do. That's what we did in the Stasi prisons. They're doing it in China. And if you can't see that there are many people in our society and in our government today that would say it's best for the public health that we help these people by re-educating them, then you're missing it. Because that's what they're going to do, unless God intervenes. Anyway, I dealt with that Sunday night at Apologia Church, so you can find that on their YouTube channel while it's still there. And I gave five foundations of things to work on, five things you can focus upon in the darkness, in your solitude, if you are isolated as a believer, to attempt to stay strong when someone's attempting to break your faith. And it's something I've thought about, and every time I talk to my fellow pastors and stuff, they've thought about it too. And so I addressed it. Sometimes I address stuff that isn't a whole lot of fun to address, but there you go. Okay, anyway, so as people are recognizing that the church's ceasefire with culture has not worked, we need to have a word from God to a society that has completely lost its collective mind and certainly its way. And so the question of theonomy is, unfortunately, has been inappropriately framed 30 years ago. Man, I wish I had this. I need to make a note to myself somehow. I need to track down Bonson's response to Westminster's book, because I've never seen Bonson spit flame like he did in this. And basically what he said was, given what's happening in our society, given what's happening in regards to homosexuality and issues like that, isn't it astonishing that when Westminster Theological Seminary can finally get all its professors together to write a book, to take a stand on one issue, it's not about homosexuality, and it's not about marriage, and it's not about any of the other things. It's against God's law. That's the one thing they can all get together and say, that's a bad thing. And I've admitted, I was influenced by that book. I graduated from seminary right at that time. And so I heard all this stuff, and I imbibed all that stuff. Now we're living in a day where we literally are in a culture that wants to make it evil to use words like father, mother, husband, wife, child, family, male, female. All the common grace stuff is gone. Okay? That ain't working. All the natural law stuff, you have to have a mind that recognizes there can be a source of coherence to have natural law. We're past that. So we've got to have a foundation to stand on. Autonomy hasn't worked. Theonomy does not mean that you take your 3-year-old to church and stone them in the front yard if they've been naughty that week. Okay? If that's what you think it's about. Now, by the way, if what God's law said about that you think is bad, you got a problem. Because you got a problem with the same law that Jesus said was holy and just and good. So did Paul. Okay? But if you think that that's what anyone who calls himself a theonomist today is saying, then you've missed it. You haven't been doing, you've only been reading one side, and mainly only on the internet. I'm not talking about Chris here. I love Chris. I'm just pushing back to Chris to go, hey, think about this, bro, because I was once there. I get it. I'm not there anymore, and here's why. For example, you mentioned Geneva. Let me try to distinguish between sacralism and a proper understanding. Now, if you want, bro, honestly, I'll send you a really good book on this. I'll send you Joe Boot's book. Because I've got about 5 or 6 sitting in my, over there. I'll send you Joe Boot's book. Drop me, DM me, man. Send me a note. If you don't have it, I'll send it to you. I've given it to other guys too, some of whom you know. Ah. But he's got some excellent chapters on theonomy and libertarianism, political libertarianism. Because people have the idea that if you're talking about theonomy, you're talking about you just simply pick up Leviticus and drop it on New York City. The first and foremost issue with what we have to think about today is, what must be the source of our law? What must be the source? If it is to be derived from the demos, the people, can you not see what that results in? We're seeing it right now. Everyone's starting to see there are now two laws in our land. There are now two laws in our land. If you're on the left, you get one set of laws, and if you're not, you get another set of laws. And the result is anarchy. That can't work. So do you want law that derives from God's revelation, or do you want law that is derived from rebellion against God? That's really the only two choices you have. Because anything that has ever been good, in anything system that man has derived, has come from God's law. Due process, where does that come from? Scripture. Innocent until proven guilty, where does that come from? Scripture. Necessity of witnesses, cross-examination, Bible, English common law, blah, 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 blah. You throw that out, what do you get? You get the Soviet Union. You get communist China. There's not much in between. Well, in fact, there's nothing in between. So, when it says it didn't work in Geneva, what do you mean by that? Because what you have in Geneva was the continuing medieval synthesis that created sacralism. And sacralism, I understand how someone would go, you want sacralism. No, I don't want sacralism. I want to speak the truth as to what God's law says, because that's how mankind knows what man is. I can't testify that every male is actually a male, is called by God to be a male and to man up, if I don't have a foundation for saying that. And you might say, well, natural science can do that. Natural science as interpreted in what world? Natural science in a world where natural science has laws that makes it consistent, sure. But now you're borrowing from my worldview again. You can see how, quote unquote, natural science is being used by everybody to substantiate everything now. Because there's no consistency in the worldview that people are embracing. So sacralism involved a incestuous connection between church and state, where the two sort of like violated the hypostatic union. Okay? So when you get the intermixture, like in Eutychianism or, Nestorianism, Apollinarianism, Eutychianism, when you're talking about Christology, you get that unnatural intermixture which ends up destroying sphere sovereignty. The church has its sphere, the state has its sphere, but they're both subspheres underneath God. And the church says to the state, here's what God says. But the church doesn't take over the role of the state in the process. And that was always the issue. I mean, from the point in time where you have the highest reach of the papacy, where you've got the Holy Roman Emperor kneeling in the snow outside the Pope's door to try to get his position back, to the reverse of that, where the Emperor completely controls the Pope, to the point where you have Leo, at the time of Luther, who's riding through Rome in armor, leading an army. Okay? That's where you've gotten this intermixture. And that's not what we're talking about. When you talk, so the presentation, I think the problem with theonomy is that you have unregenerate men attempting to apply and submit others to God's law. The question is, what law is going to actually correspond to the need of any man, whether unregenerate or regenerate? And the regenerate or unregenerate state of the person enforcing the law cannot be the determining factor. The state, the question is, are we going to seek to have God's blessing on our state, or are we going to live in rebellion against God? This nation, imperfect as the men were, every historical document says, wanted God's blessing on this nation. And they weren't talking about Allah. They were talking about the God of Abraham. And so the question is, where are you going to get that law? You get all the unregenerate men together and they come up with a law for unregenerate men? That'll be rebellion. That'll be chaos. Where do you get the substance of what that law is to be? That's what the question is. And so I think it misrepresents what the issue is. What is theonomy? Theonomy is not unregenerate men attempting to apply and submit others to God's law. The only person who's going to submit to God's law is the person who has that law written upon their heart, first of all. But that doesn't change the fact that God's law was what allowed God to bless a people, blesses a nation whose God is Yahweh. But then Proverbs says sin is a rebuke upon any nation. Well, where's that sin? How do you define what that sin is? It says any nation. So when the pagan nations broke God's law, that was a stain upon them, according to Scripture. So, what does that mean? So, there. Oh, yes?
So, your point earlier about blood guilt.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a short leash. I got to get you some more rope there. But your point earlier about blood guilt is well taken, because if one can step past the secular mockery that is made of God's law and cannot understand what it's reading, frankly, and you just simply go through each element of the law and you go, okay, let's look at the categories that the Scripture actually lays out, whether that's blood guiltiness, there's prosperity concepts there. Mm-hmm. If you do this, you will prosper. Guess what? If you don't, you won't. The land will spew you out. Things like that. Then you get into practical things. There's health code there. Mm-hmm. There is building code there. You got leprosy on your wall. Hey,
financial issues.
Financial issues, usury laws, the whole nine yards. You go through that and you start to find out this is actually very sensible. And the big thing about each and every point is that the Lord hates dishonest scales. The law, what he's objecting to, what Chris is objecting to, isn't the law, isn't the theonomy, it's the carrying out by unequal scales.
Right.
By police officers and judges and the system. And that's what we have, for instance, today, where we have Maxine Waters all upset about January 6th, and yet her whole party in Congress covers over what she did over the weekend.
Yep.
But you go back to God's law and you start finding out, you know what? If you want to look at this even on a practical level, it makes a lot of sense, because it's just. It's just. And if we just simply take that in a serious way instead of all of this unserious childlike behavior by people walking.
We're not talking about Chris there.
No, but people walking around in adult bodies behaving like little children,
yeah. You
know, maybe we might have a hope in this land.
Yeah, well, that thing with Samuel was just absolutely astonishing. I'm sorry I got so upset about that, but anyway. So there, Chris, there's my response. I didn't want to write all that in Twitter, and I don't know it would have gotten anywhere, but hopefully that is helpful to you, and maybe we can pick up from there. So, all right. That's about everything for today. I turned Fox News off, so I don't know what all has been happening since then. I guess I need to sort of catch up and find out. But I can guarantee you they've probably already filed for their appeals, and we'll go from there. But on Thursday, we will be back, and I'm not sure which studio we'll be in, but have a feeling probably the other one, because why? I don't know. But you're supposed to have tally lights put together tomorrow, right? So I know which camera to look at. Yeah, so I sort of like doing the Trent Horn stuff over there, because I can use the big board and put stuff like that there. So we'll see. Anyways, thanks for listening to the program today. We'll see you next time. God bless.